Modern-day Israel and the global Jewish community continue to be strongly influenced by the memory and horrors of the Holocaust, 63 years after the defeat of Nazi Germany. In his controversial new book, The Holocaust is Over, We Must Rise from Its Ashes, Avraham Burg argues that the Shoah, as it's called in Hebrew, has so traumatized Israel that the country has lost the ability to trust itself, its neighbors, and the world around it. His book is being published in this country by Palgrave Macmillan, and Mr. Burg, one of Israel's most prominent politicians and intellectuals, joins me now. Welcome.
Hi. Shalom.
Initially, you were going to call this book Hitler Won. Why?
Let's skip to the next question.
Okay.
No, I'll try. I mean, that was the name of the fire on my laptop for so many months that I faced it daily. Because when the book is a journey. It's not just a kind of digging into myself and the relations between myself and my parents. My father escaped from Germany at the very last moment of September 39 from all month. And the Israeli situation, and I looked around and I saw how something I didn't realize, that how the Holocaust is actually omnipresent in our life, in rhetorics, in politics, in strategy, in daily life, all around. And I said to myself, listen, a nation was abused, and not everybody, individual or collective, who is so brutally abused can go out of the trauma. And I had a feeling that maybe we're there. I mean, we cannot be redeemed. Only later during the journey and deep into the book, I discovered the other components, which are there is a chance, there is a hope, and therefore we have to defeat Hitler. We're not yet there, but we can do it.
And actually, the title in Israel was Defeating Hitler.
Right.
Going along with what you just said, you write that the show is such a constant part of life in Israel that it has become a theological pillar of modern Judaism. Theological pillar.
Yeah. You know, first, if it was not, it would have been a kind of a surprise or a kind of an escapism, so to say, because, listen, it is such a huge traumatic horror that it's only natural that a nation and individuals still, the living witnesses are still living amongst us, family members and neighbors and friends and associates, etc. It would have been strange not to be that consumed by the experience. But on the other hand,
but I'm talking about the word theological here.
Yeah.
Especially in the light of the fact that your last book was called God is Back.
Yeah, which is not an autobiography, okay? It's a kind of a discussion about the religious dimension of world conflicts and Israeli conflict, etc., within and around us. I know what troubles you. Theological means theo, the God is in the center of it. But on the other hand, theological is a kind of a set of value system of faith and behaviors and rituals and rites, etc., that behaves like a religion, behaves like a faith. And when you look at the behavior of the Holocaust tradition and the Holocaust existence, spirituality in our life, it is there.
Well, you are a religious observant Jew, yet you didn't join any of the religious political parties. In fact, Labor, your party, is generally the most secular of all the Israeli political parties, isn't it?
I was born into a very, very, and one more very political party in my political life. My father was the leader of the National Religious Party and was a minister in each and every cabinet in Israel from 48 to 88. I mean, very long political life. And the only serious ideological disagreement I've had with my father was about this issue. He believed that the state of Israel is the dawn of our redemption. It has a kind of a redemptive meaning, a kind of a religious meaning. And I told him, Daddy, it is so dangerous each and every time Jewish politics merged with Jewish messianism, ended up in a catastrophe, in a disaster. We cannot go this way. And he said, Boychik, I lived through the horrors. I went through it. Listen, for me, it's a redemption. You can do whatever you like. And I'm a believer, a great believer in a separation. You cannot say church and state in Israel. So let's say a Knesset and Beit Knesset, or rabbi and sovereign. I would like to see a wall of separation between them, because I'm afraid from this messianic political merger. And therefore, my religion is something to do with my private realm, something to do with the community and the congregation. God forbid it should not be part of the state and state's politics. And my politics is my public domain. So I joined a party which at the time reflected my value system. Not anymore. I'll support some other party these elections. But nonetheless, that was part of the ideology.
And why? Where has Labour gone that has led you to reject it? Or is it you who have changed?
I take it it's both, okay? Well, Labour is gone. I have no idea when we shall find it. I'll tell you where it is. But it evaporated. It simply is not relevant for the two or three most significant components of our public life. Labour was supposed to be the alternative to the arch capitalist neoconservative economy of Israel of the last 10 years or so. And it is not. It is as a neoconservative, economically speaking, as Bibi Netanyahu and other right-wing elements. And when it comes to the peace process, it does not show its full, absolute commitment to the peace process. And therefore, the Labour is not there. And at the same time, I'm changed as well.
So it lost its initial socialist ideal, but also it changed after the assassination of Yitzhak Rabin? I mean, is that one of the reasons that it changed?
It's a very, very good question. I have to think about it. No doubt Yitzhak Rabin's assassination is a watershed. My feeling is that the Labour did not go into the soul-searching required in order to reinvent itself or to have a kind of a new modern time renaissance. And one of the problems is that we are still there into the assassination of Rabin and this kind of rhetoric, which is not actual and is not relevant for the daily political life in Israel.
I'm talking with Avraham Burg about his book, The Holocaust is Over, We Must Rise from Its Ashes, which is published in this country by Palgrave Macmillan. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. You argued that the Shoah is directly responsible for many of modern-day Israel's political ills, its security policy, xenophobia, and paranoia. Well, don't Israelis have a reason to feel a bit paranoid in the light of suicide bombings and the like?
A bit is not enough. We have many reasons to believe that to be paranoid, because there is somebody there behind us in the woods with a big bat. But it is not about that, not that much about that. It's about something else. Nations, especially in modern time, should be suspicious. America should be, and Europe should be, and even India should be. But is it the only cause? Is it the only raison d'être, the only reason of being, just to be paranoid, just to be cautious, just to be careful, just to be defensive? Or is there something else? And my feeling is there should be something else.
So are you saying that Shoah has become both an excuse and a reason for some of Israel's most controversial actions?
Yeah. On one hand, I fully understand where people are coming from, and I know so many of my relatives and so many of my friends and so my family included, that they say, Avraham, we're still there. It's too early for us, your kind of arguments. And I say, yes, I know the book is a kind of an early book. It's not a late previous generation argument. It's an early next generation argument, because in our lifetime, or our children's lifetime, the first ever generation to born without a living witness who was there will be born. And my question is, what will be the shape and the design and the state of mind of the gestalt of this new generation? Will it be a cloning, a cut pace of previous traumas repeated to the next generation? Or can we offer it a way, a road, slowly but surely, out of trauma and into trust? And my book is an offer for the next generation discourse.
And what is happening with the younger people? In Germany, there have been big breaks from generation to generation, mm-hmm. from the generation that lived during the Nazi era to the one that was born afterward and subsequent ones. That hasn't happened in Israel. Would a young person today, born 60 years or so after Shoah, still be affected by the power of the legacy?
both in Israel and in American Jewry, the presence of the Shoah, the presence of the Holocaust is a molding experience. And we do something that I bitterly oppose, and with five of my kids I failed, but with Noam, the youngest one, I persuaded him. I'm very much against the, before the army, before the military service, annual trip to Auschwitz. I think it's a kind of a wrong emotional, some will say education, some will say manipulation, in the sense you take somebody at the age that the blood is boiling and hot and the emotions are there, and just before the military service, and you take him or her to Auschwitz, which is a moving experience.
So this is a traditional pilgrimage.
This apropos theology, okay, apropos a kind, yes, it's a pilgrimage. And it is such a powerful educational tool that eventually clones the trauma for the next generation. I think it is wrong. We should go there, but later on, we are more mature after the military service, when you have wider perspective to the situation. And this is just one example to tell you that no, there is no yet a generational departure from the previous experience.
Because the message is we have to be ever vigilant, never again. And if you're going into the military, that might very well be an impetus for acting in a certain way.
But that's exactly part of my argument. You know, one of my early mentors, who was an Auschwitz survivor as a kid, said two people came out of Auschwitz. Those who said never again for Jews. So let's have the strongest army possible, the thickest walls around us, the deepest shelter possible, just to make sure that never again is never again for us. And some others, like my parents, like my father, like myself, like the parents of the beloved parents of my wife, and many others, are saying, never again is never again to anybody who needs us around the world. Never again is never again this kind of massacre. Never again is I, who was the ultimate victim of yesterday, must make sure that there will be no more victimization and slaughters and genocides around the world. And my book is actually one of the first voices expressing the alternative, more universalist, more humane, never again, rather than the traditional dig-in Jewish, Israeli alternative.
There are any number of people who've told me, Israelis who've come here, that one of the reasons they didn't want to stay was because they were upset that they felt they were part of they said they went to Gaza, this is in the old days, and they felt it was the equivalent of a concentration camp, or maybe that was overstating the case, but, you know, they were horrified by what Israel was partly responsible for creating. Not that there wasn't culpability on all sides.
It's not an easy argument, the one you bring here. It's not an easy argument because, yes, it is very, very difficult to be a good, sensitive humanist in Israel when you see what happens around and you actually do not see any serious commitment on the side of the politicians to try to go out of the situation. Rabin, we mentioned, was the last one who was seriously committed to it. And on the other hand, what you just described is part of the problems I see in Israel in a very dialectic way. We compare, we compare everything to the Holocaust. So we say to ourselves, well, Gaza is awful, Gaza is a shame, but is it the gas chambers? The answer is no. So it's okay, it's kosher. The problem is when you compare so many daily relative proportioned issues to the absolute disaster, so it makes it legitimate, and I say it is wrong to compare everything to the Holocaust. Let's compare it to itself and say Gaza is awful and let's walk out of it.
But the Holocaust really is only something that was experienced by some of the Jews who make up Israel. There are the Middle Eastern Jews as well who didn't really have that experience.
Well, Leonard, you're right physically and you're wrong psychologically. I saw a movie made by JDC recently about a village built in Rwanda by an American donor, using the Israeli experience of absorbing the youth to try to solve the problems of Rwanda that we all know. So it's a youth village.
The Hutu and Tutsi conflict.
Exactly, which, you know, is a massacre, awful massacre by itself. And one of the instructor and teachers or instructors or whatever it is, there is an Ethiopian girl, and she gave an interview in this beautiful PR video clip, and she says, "Listen, we who went through the Holocaust, we must contribute our experience to help the Tutsi and Hutu overcome whatever they have. It's a molding experience. It is not something that happened to you individually. It's the collective state of mind."
But as a member of the Falashim, the Ethiopian Jews, she must have felt discriminated against as well, and made that connection.
I just brought it as an anecdote. We're not going down.
No, but I wonder whether it also becomes to some degree a metaphor for the discrimination that Jews have experienced wherever they were. At least at some times, there were times when Jews thrived in different places, but often they were discriminated against.
Not that straightforward. Okay, Israel, which is a society of people coming from difficult places, I mean, former Soviet Union, the Nazi regime, a Muslim world, etc. In Israel, in the very early years, there was a competition of traumas, and the Holocaust won over, and unfortunately all the other traumas of people coming from North Africa, coming from Yemen, coming from Iraq, Mesopotamia, wherever they come from, was not fully recognized, and therefore the trauma of the immigration and absorption is not yet fully dealt with. But, and this is the most important argument that I argue in my book and in the positions I take, not always very popular among Israelis.
And we'll get to that.
Yeah, and the Holocaust is across the board common denominator. Ashkenazim and Sfaradim, Muslim world Jews and Christian world Jews, it's across the board.
My guest is Avraham Burg. His book, The Holocaust is Over, We Must Rise from Its Ashes, published by Palgrave Macmillan. Might be interested in knowing that Mr. Burg will be answering questions on WNYC's Art Cult blog as part of the New York Public Library's live series. You can submit your questions if you go to our show page at WNYC.org. And we will be back with more of our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. Avraham Burg has been active in politics as a leader in the Labor Party and the One Israel Party. He's written for The Guardian, the International Herald Tribune, and his book, The Holocaust is Over, We Must Rise from Its Ashes, was a bestseller when it was published in Israel. But it did cause quite a bit of controversy, and you outraged a few people, didn't you? Atniel Schneller, who is a Knesset member from the ruling Kadima party, said that when you die, you should be denied burial in the part of Jerusalem's Mount Herzl National Cemetery allotted to national figures. He also said you had better search for a grave in another country. How do you respond to something like that?
On one hand, I smiled, and on the other hand, I was very sad. I was smiled because... this Mr. Schneller didn't read my book, has no clue what I'm talking about, and the only thing he can tell me is, I wish you dead and buried some other place. I mean, this is not a serious conversation. I mean, read my book, talk to me, agree, disagree, adopt part of it, reject some of it.
Well, does that say something about the state of Israeli politics today?
No, it says...
Or does it just say something about Mr. Schneller?
About his state, for sure, but the book was very controversial, so let me tell you about a pillow talk, if I may, okay, between Yael, my wife, and myself. Here is the period that the manuscript is not with me anymore and not yet published. And I told her one morning that I thought about it. I said, listen, Yael, it's not in my hands anymore, but I wonder if there will be no reaction and the attitude of the Israelis will be, you know, the classical indifference that we can be indifferent to so many other things. So it means that we are doomed, that the Israeli society is spiritually dead, because if somebody like myself is coming with an argument like that and nobody responds to it, oh, that's bad. And then the book was published Wednesday, and Thursday, Leonard, it was there. I mean, everybody was on me, and I was on everybody else, and it was such a great controversy, such a big polemic. And I love polemic because polemic is a situation which, if you agree with me and I agree with you, it's a dead world. But if we disagree and we sharpen the disagreements, a kind of a Hegelian synthesis is born between us. And it's important Jewish and Talmudic tool of creation. So the controversy was out. And
do you expect that to extend to this country? Because American Jewry plays a major part in the story, doesn't it?
If the first, I see the reaction of so many of my friends, and I have so many friends who are the establishment. They say, Avrum, we wish you well, but move to the other block, okay? Don't stop at our doorstep. And I understand that many of the Jewish institutions in this country are based on the Shoah notion and the anti-Semitism actions, etc. And I offer a different venue. So if the reaction here will be like in Israel, which is most of the people who are 50 plus, or Mr. Israel or Mr. Jew here, who are well off economically and they're used to the stereotypes we used to be brought up upon, et cetera, that something like the American Jews, they believe that we are Israelis, we are all heroes, and we believe that they are all rich, and unfortunately only 50% of it is true. So, okay, this generation is lost to me, but the children, like in Israel, it's a generational issue. Thousands of them are coming to me. I meet them every week, groups and emails and faxes saying, Avrum, we do not necessarily agree with your questions, but with your answers, but thank God you allow us to ask questions. So if I have the next generation of American Jewry, I'll be happy.
Well, in the book you say it's time for a new Judaism.
It is time for a new Judaism.
What would that be?
First, read my next book, okay? Before you send me out of the studio.
No, I have other things to talk about here.
New Judaism at least is something, is an entity which is having a different relations with its external environment. I believe that the most important question of my generation as a Jew, and imagine that 97% of the Jews are living in the Democratic Hemisphere, both in Israel, United States of America, and the rest of the world. We have 20,000 Jews in Iran, 4,000 Jews in Morocco, and 2 Jews in Afghanistan who do not talk to each other. And this is more or less it. Most of us are living in the post-rescue era and post-rescue democratic situation. For this generation, for sure for the next one, the most important question is, can the Jewish people survive without an external enemy? Give me a war, give me a program, give me a disaster. My DNA knows what to do with it.
But you seem to have suggested that, to some degree, Israel has played a role in creating that external enemy.
And I want to depart from it.
5 years ago, when Hamas was carrying out a suicide bombing campaign, you published an article in the mass circulation daily Yediot Aharonot, which
recent
was
news,
then republished
year, yeah,
worldwide. And yeah, you said, Israel, having ceased to care about the children of the Palestinians, should not be surprised when they come washed in hatred and blow themselves up in the centers of Israeli escapism.
Yesterday, first to finish the previous one, and this is, I believe that we must develop Judaism which has a discourse and conversation with the world against it, around it, rather than stick to the ghetto shtetl mentality, which we are into our own and do not have any connection to the external world. That's the new Judaism, which is about universalism and humanity and liberties, etc., inside and outside as well.
But that's
and
always been a part of Judaism, hasn't it?
Yeah, but hushed so much in the last couple of years and generations, and I think we should renew it. As for the article I wrote, it was not a long article in which I said Israel must make up its mind. It is impossible, simply impossible. It was in the middle of the second intifada, the year 2000 and something, silence all around, bloodshed all around. I said it's impossible for Israelis to continue to think that we can maintain the great land of Israel and democracy and the Jewish nature of the state of Israel without compromising. It's impossible. If it's the greater land of Israel, you lose the Jewish majority. So what do? You compromise, you give up democracy, or you give up the Jewish nature of the state of Israel. Make up your mind, Israelis. And alongside of not deciding and trying both to answer to the settlers who abducted the Israeli reality and push us and persuade us and force us to remain into this great land of Israel, we lost the sensitive ear to what happens to the occupied. And this is wrong. I mean, I who was occupied for 2,000 years cannot be all of a sudden deaf to the cries of the other people. And therefore, the article is about calling Israel to make up a strategic decision rather than try to contain all of these contradictions and be happy with ourselves, but dig in more and more and more into our own grave.
And you're arguing that the Shoah has produced a perpetual hysteria that promotes extremism that doesn't allow for that kind of empathy.
Yeah, this part emotionally I understand, but I do not accept. In the sense that how the masses feel, I know. But what should be the leadership's reaction? You know, I listened very carefully to the campaign in America, and I listened to this notion of so many people saying, if Barack Obama will be elected, now elected, it will be the last chapter of slavery. I mean, you heard this notion here intellectually and politically and ideologically, maybe even in this studio, okay? And it takes years, it takes generations, it takes eras to overcome yesterday's serious trauma. I say the same about politics. I'm looking for the Israeli politician to say the trauma happened. We must internalize its lesson but move forward. Let's not leave the past only.
Along those lines, I asked Toni Morrison whether we turned a corner with the election of Barack Obama. She said, well, that's for the white people to decide. My guest is Avram Burg. His book, The Holocaust.
What's the Israeli equivalent? Okay.
The Holocaust is Over, We Must Arise from Its Ashes, published by Palgrave Macmillan. One of the most controversial themes is in the book, and this relates to what we've been talking about, is your comparison of Germany's Second Reich to modern-day Israel. How do you think Israel's treatment of the Arabs is similar to Germany's treatments of Jews during that time?
I made it very clear, though people did not pay much of attention, that I speak about the period of the Second Reich till the fall down of the Weimar Republic, not about the Nazi period, which is too big. It's out of this historic realm or discussion. And I compare it because first I wanted to compare it to the first white pioneers here and the Native American, Native nations. And I said, no, it's not about this. It's not about this. It's about something else. What happened is that in Germany, the two most important books shaped our modern history were written. Herzl's The State of the Jews and Hitler's Mein Kampf, two books, both in Germany. And I asked myself, what was there in Germany of the time that, or in the German premises of the time, that actually was so powerful for my history? And I realized that there was something deep there. There was a competition between over-liberal and openness and new ideas and new trend and new spirits. And at the same time, there was trauma there. Germany was humiliated and traumatized by the family of nations. And the competition between trauma and hope, trauma and hope, trauma and hope, was there all during the years that eventually trauma won. And I say in Israel we have the same competition between trauma and hope, between the energies of renewal and renaissance, and still the trauma we dedicated the last hour or so to speak about. And I warn ourselves, be aware, sometimes trauma wins, not always hope wins. And my argument is, when you see it, when you see the mirror of the German precedent in front of your eyes, do your utmost to make sure that our hope wins over our traumas.
A listener wrote in this question, the United Nations Security Council said that Israel's wall and the settlers it installed in the occupied territory are illegal. Do you think the European Union should pressure Israel to comply with international law by evacuating the occupied territory and tearing down the wall?
The situation in the occupied territories is awful. It's bad for us. It's bad for the Palestinians. It's bad for the world. We are now in a situation that both us and them locked, our horns are so locked, we cannot get out of the situation, and we need the external persuasion. Whatever the persuasion is it talking or is it pressuring? And it cannot happen because of European Union. There should be a kind of an international one policy, American, United Nations, and Europe. And they should come to Israel and to Palestinians and say, this is the situation, this is what we expect of you, and this is the carrot as a reward. If this will happen, especially led by Obama and Hillary Clinton, I see a chance.
Well, in the early days when Israel occupied the territories, they talked about them as a bargaining chip for peace. Then
not
something
anymore.
Happened.
Not anymore. If we are true to ourselves, part of it has to do with the political fear of what do we do when the trauma of the civil war will erupt between the settlers and the rest of the society. And the deeper part has to do with the fact that so many Israelis are... do not reject, to put it mildly, do not reject the messianic notion of the settlers' movement. So it's not just a struggle, yes to settle, not to settle, yes to evacuate, not to evacuate, but do we depart from the messianic politics of Israel of the last 40 years or not? I say we should.
Well, the settlers were removed from Gaza, and there was some turmoil, but there wasn't civil war.
In Gaza, from the evacuation and the removal of the settlers, it was very promising from the side of the Israeli arrogance of we do it unilaterally and there is no partner and we do not care about what happens to the other side. That was stupid at best and not wise otherwise. We should talk. As much as the enemy is not the most beloved one and I don't like him or her, we must talk, with Hamas included.
Well, people have often come to the conclusion that there has to be a two-state solution, but is it possible for Israel to keep on going with the one-state solution?
You're right to hint that the current situation is a one-state solution. The days of the two-state solution formula are numbered, not because it's the only viable solution. It is. Otherwise, it will be a bloodshed all around the spectrum, but because both societies were abducted by a religious fundamental minority which prevents the majority from expressing itself. It is Israel was abducted by religious, messianic, fundamentalist settlers' policy, and the Palestinians were abducted by the same from their side. The Israeli side is having the greater land of Israel, one-state solution and dream, and the Palestinians are having the greater Palestine one-state solution, and these extremists are feeding each other, and we must release ourselves from their... from being their hostages.
But even if people do believe in two-state solution, there are those sticky issues, the Arab world's demand for the right of return, the whole matter of whether Jerusalem should be the capital of a Palestinian state or an Israeli state or somehow split and be a joint capital.
The lines of the solution are more or less known and accepted by all, including the Arab League, which are Clinton's formula, 67 lines in Jerusalem, whatever is Arab will go to Palestinian, whatever is Jewish will go to Israel. And even the formulas, both for the Temple Mount and the sovereignty over the Temple Mount, which is such a volatile religious issue and symbolic issue, and solutions and formulas for the refugees not coming back to Israel, but coming back to the state of Palestine, or just being institutionalized, so to say, in the places they live, Damascus and Egypt, etc., and Jordan. The formulas are there. It is not about the line of solution. It is about the courage of leaders. And this is a commodity we have a shortage yet.
Because people are afraid of all the blood that will be spilled if a deal is made?
There are many reasons. There are many, many reasons. For many years, I thought that the primary sin of the Israeli society is the occupation. We just get rid of the settlements. We just go back to the good old Israel, and everything is, it's a remedy. It's a deus ex machina. Now I say it is not. We have to solve other problems first. And if I have a second for these other problems, I'll say next time we come to the table, let's address the traumas and the fears of the other side. Let them address ours. And only then, when we respect the pains of the other, we should move forward to the real estate issues.
A reminder that Avram Berg will be answering questions on WNYC's Art Cult blog as part of the New York Public Library's live series. You can submit your questions if you go to our show page at WNYC.org. His book, The Holocaust is Over, We Must Rise from Its Ashes, is published by Palgrave Macmillan. Thank you so much.